I just felt that, you know, I needed to help in some way. The fire, you know, I just felt compelled to help.
And so I just decided to go on my one-wheel skateboard and get 6 loaves of bread and some peanut butter and jelly, and that turned into about 400 sandwiches yesterday. And then we thought, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are simple. They can be packed away, and they reconnect you with your childhood, too. And so whenever you come from your heart, good things happen.
This fire has impacted me personally, emotionally, and I have a lot of friends who have been evacuated, who have lost homes. And so one of the things that I'm doing with a group of businesses in Hayward, we are starting our toiletry drive.
So many people are showing up to help neighbors, friends, even strangers who've been affected by the LA fires. They're volunteering, they're donating, they're hosting people who've evacuated, or organizing drives to collect toiletries and clothes. Turns out, science shows we humans are actually wired for this kind of kindness and connection and empathy.
When people are at their most needy, when we're all going through something together, there's an urgent sense of togetherness. There's an urgent sense that we are all in need of each other, and so we all need to be there for each other. And so I think that's what elevates these wonderful human tendencies during our darkest times.
That's Dr. Jamil Zaki, who runs the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab. He's a professor of psychology, and he's the author of Hope for Cynics, The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. And as part of a new series we're launching on resilience, he's here to help us understand the data-driven reasons why we shouldn't be cynical, even in really hard times. It's so great to have you here, Jamil.
Thanks, Sasha. I'm happy to be here.
Just give us the basics of, like, what does the science tell us about human goodness?
The science is pretty clear that there is a lot of goodness in human beings. In fact, as you said, that in some ways we are wired for connection with each other, to help each other, to be there for one another. That's frankly what makes our species who we are. And I'm always thrilled to share that science. I deeply believe in it, in part because I see the data myself. So here are some examples. One, people tend to act kindly when they're not thinking about it. So if you ask people to make decisions very quickly, they tend to make kinder decisions than if they spend a long time deliberating. If you look at stories from the Carnegie Heroes Project, these are people who have risked their lives to save strangers. If you look at interviews with them, which have been coded by scientists, they often say, "I didn't think about it. I just ran into the burning building. I wasn't trying to calculate whether this would be good for my reputation or whether, you know, I would become a hero. I just did it." And another level of analysis comes from our biology. So in my lab, we found that when people donate to charity or give money to somebody in need, the same parts of their brain are active as when they eat chocolate, for instance.
Wow.
Or experience something else pleasurable. So these data points all lead us to think a couple of things. One, that although I'm not here to say people are generally good and we're not bad, there is a lot about us that seems to lead us naturally towards acts of kindness, helping, and togetherness.
Yet, and you write about this, you know, we kind of have this trope, right, of the cynic being cooler or, you know, somehow like it's naive to be optimistic or to be hopeful. Tell me more about that. I mean, also the idea that, you know, to be optimistic is somehow to be privileged.
These are all stereotypes in our culture. One, that cynicism is smart and feeling good about humanity or the world is naive and somehow dull. Another, that cynicism is more radical, right, and leads to change, and that maybe feeling faith in humanity is, as you said, a privilege that might lead us to accept the status quo. It's almost as though our culture has decided that if you think things are good, you are bad in some way, which is an ironic move. If you ask people who would be smarter, a cynic or a non-cynic, about 70% of people think that cynics would outperform non-cynics on cognitive tests, for instance. But the opposite is true. People who trust others more, who have more faith in people, tend to actually do better on those tests than cynical people. We also find in research that cynicism is not radical at all, that cynics actually are less likely to vote, less likely to take part in social movements. And in fact, they're more likely to embrace, for instance, authoritarian leaders. Because if you don't trust the people around you, if you think that people are generally awful, what do you need? You need somebody to protect you from your fellow citizens. So authoritarianism actually benefits from a cynical population. Totalitarians, propagandists have been using cynicism to pit people against each other for decades, if not centuries.
Mm. So cynicism, in a way, is paralyzing in that it's keeping people from working for change.
If you want things to stay the same, one of the best things that you can do is encourage people to believe that nothing can get better.
You know, a lot of people are feeling really cynical right now because of all of the difficult things we're facing in our state, not just the wildfires, but, you know, climate change, political division, financial troubles. So many people are feeling vulnerable and uncertain about the future. And Californians we've been talking to seem to really echo this feeling of being pretty cynical about 2025. I want to play you some of what we've heard talking to people across the state.
Would you say that you're feeling more or less hopeful about the state of the world right now?
Definitely less hopeful. Definitely getting less hopeful.
I am not feeling that hopeful about the world right now. I want to be like a positive person.
I live in perpetual hope, and yet, like, currently it's quite difficult.
It seems like people are not trusting of each other, you know, with all the polarization. Throughout my whole life, I've always been trusting of people, and I've always felt, like, optimistic at that about things. But I think these days, my optimism is disappearing, and my cynicism is rising.
I resonate so much with what these folks are saying. I mean, these are difficult times, and I think that a lot of us feel a loss of possibility right now.
But you found, and you talk about in this book, how actually, you know, we are maybe not as politically divided as we might think.
Absolutely. I mean, first, let's stipulate we are divided. We are more divided than we were in the past. And something that's really troubling about American division now is that it's become personal. We've disagreed for decades about everything you can imagine, but now more than before, more than a couple of decades ago, for instance, people imagine that somebody that they disagree with is stupid and evil and mean-spirited and violent. And we hate the people we disagree with much more than we did before, which is, of course, a dangerous state of affairs. I think it's especially dangerous and sad because it's not always totally necessary, right? What we imagine about the quote-unquote other side is wrong in basically every way that scientists can measure. We're wrong about their demographics, for instance. Democrats think that a quarter of Republicans make more than $250,000 a year. The real number is 2%, for instance. We think that the average person we disagree with is much more extreme than they really are, is twice as hateful, twice as anti-democratic, and four times as violent as they really are. We also underestimate the amount of common ground that we have, even on specific issues. So I'm not saying that America is a harmonious nation or that just we could easily snap into some type of kumbaya situation on a national level. But I do think that there's much more that we share than we realize.
Well, your lab actually did a very cool project where you had 100 Americans or so talk with each other across divides over Zoom. Tell me what came out of that.
We brought these folks together to talk about gun control, abortion, and climate change. You know, freewheeling, easy.
Right.
No, these were really difficult subjects. We prepared them and made sure that they really disagreed on all three issues specifically. And we asked them before the conversations, how do you think this is going to go? And on a 1 to 100 scale, where 1 is absolutely the worst conversation you could have, and 100 is a delightful conversation. And in general, people said, well, we'll be somewhere between neutral and awful. After the conversations, we asked them again, how would you rate this on a 1 to 100 scale? And the most common response we got was a 100 out of 100. People were absolutely shocked. They were shocked at how positive these conversations were, at how reasonable the person they disagreed with was. That's not to say that they agreed, And I want to be really clear that empathy and connection is not the same as condoning what other people feel or agreeing with them. But these people found that they could at least respect each other's humanity and have productive dialogue. And afterwards, they didn't just feel better about the person that they talked with. They felt less prejudiced against outsiders in general. So Democrats felt better about Republicans. Republicans felt better about Democrats. And those effects lasted 3 months after the conversation. So we rarely have chances for dialogue like this, but when they occur, they are much better than we expect them to be.
Hmm. And did you find that across the board, like regardless of age, race?
It was a huge effect that was actually the strongest for people who were most pessimistic going into the conversations. In general, people don't trust their fellow citizens, but they do trust the people who they see, their neighbors, their grocer, their bus driver, right? So generally speaking, the closer you get to humanity, the better you feel about it. And that to me is a really powerful data point. And I think this is something that I want to say about cynicism in general. You know, it's a really natural response, but generally it's one that's easy to come by when you're not actually interacting with human beings. I think cynicism lives on the many screens that surround us all throughout our lives. And it's very easy when you focus on those representations of people to flatten them and to fear them. So we allow ourselves to be driven towards these dreary representations, these hopeless representations, which, let's say it again, advantages the status quo. Because we decide, well, people are just kind of rotten. So if things are bad, if the system is oppressing me or some group of people, if there's inequality, if there's injustice, that's just who we are. But actually, the closer you look, the more you see evidence that that's not what people want. That's not what people tend to be like in their everyday lives. And so to me, the message, as you said, is data-driven, right? Hope doesn't need to be this rose-colored pair of glasses where you're ignoring what life is really like. It can mean seeing very clearly the many problems that surround us, but knowing that many, if not most of us, want something better. One of the most powerful things about our species is that our response to suffering is to come together, because that's what we're good at. I mean, if you think about us as animals, we're not that impressive. We're medium-sized mammals. We can't run that fast or swim that well. We certainly can't fly. Our super skill is togetherness. That's what has allowed us to, you know, hunt woolly mammoths and build suspension bridges and write arias. You know, all of this comes from our ability to be together, and we do that most during difficult times.
Jamil, for those of us who are cynics in recovery, can you walk us through, like, what can people do on an everyday basis to fight cynicism? I think you have like a three-step plan.
Yeah. One is to fact check our cynical feelings, right? So oftentimes, and again, this happens to me all the time, I'll meet somebody and I'll just kind of not trust them for no reason. I'll just kind of have a bad vibe. Or I'll think about a group of people, like, let's say politicians, and say, they're all like this. And those are reasonable conclusions. We're often told to trust our gut, you know, to trust our instincts. Even if you meet somebody and you kind of get a bad vibe, then you should just avoid them. But there are so many instincts that we have that we would never trust. You know, human beings tend, for instance, to judge people more when they're hungry than when they're not hungry. Right? I would not want to use my hangriness as a guide to how I treat other people. So I try in those moments to say, well, what evidence, Jamil, do you have for this claim about this person? It's a pretty bold claim to say they're a bad person, though you know nothing about them. Are you sure that this is a defensible position? Oftentimes, for me at least, the answer is absolutely not. I don't have enough data to draw this conclusion. So then the next step is to collect more data. I call this taking leaps of faith on people. Give people chances to show you who they are. Right? That doesn't mean, you know, giving your bank information to a prince who's going to wire you $14 million. but just taking little chances on people, little risks on people, and also paying attention to what they give back. One version of this is striking up conversations with strangers. the data are pretty clear. If you actually try to talk with strangers or observe more carefully what they do in response to your actions, people are way friendlier than we think they'll be. So just putting yourself out there, being a little bit vulnerable, and seeing what comes back is another way to build hope. And then the third way is to monitor what we're sharing. You know, oftentimes we tend to think in negative terms, but we also tend to speak in negative terms. If we have had 8 positive interactions during a day and then one person was sort of a jerk to us, who are we going to talk about later on? I know who it's going to be for me. It's that jerk, you know. And at one point, I was actually driving my kids to school and somebody cut me off in traffic. This was a couple of years ago. And I started saying all sorts of things about them. And my daughter said, you know, Dad, you don't talk about all the people who didn't cut you off. Wisdom from the mouth of babes, right? And so ever since then, we've been trying something called positive gossip, where each day I try, and the other people in my family, we all try to gather one example of human goodness from that day and share it in the evening. And that does a couple of things. One, hopefully we counter each other's cynicism. But another is that when you know that you're going to share something, you start to look for it more. So for me, positive gossip has sort of popped up an antenna where I now look for more instances of people being friendly or kind. And it turns out that once you're looking for that, they're not at all hard to find.
Dr. Jamil Zaki, thank you so much.
This has been delightful. Thank you, Sasha.
Dr. Jamil Zaki runs Stanford's Social Neuroscience Lab. His book is called Hope for Cynics: The Surprising Science of Human Goodness.